No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype your questions to BBSRADIOPR. Maria's off tonight. She's got some important family business going on, and I very much appreciate her filling in for me for a few weeks while I was out actively campaigning to win the Democratic primary for re-election. And we're going to have our special guest host, the wild and crazy and always insightful Doug, is going to be with us tonight. But first, I want to run down a couple of quick statistics for you. We have another co-signer on our statehood bill in the United States Senate. So we want to give a shout out to Senator Udall from New Mexico, Democrat. He makes 25 on our statehood bill to make the District of Columbia the 51st state. In addition to that, we have 159 in the House. That's the most we've ever had. So thank you, Senator Udall, for your support. And we're looking for new co-sponsors every week. And we hope we'll keep on going up that, making the tally go up. We also shot a couple of commercials. My colleague shot a commercial with Dave Chappelle, the comedian, who's also a Washingtonian this week, a PSA, for DC statehood. It's really good. I hope you guys can look for it on the internet. Go and do Dave Chappelle, DC statehood, and it should pop up. And we also did one with Miss Huerta, who was the co-founder of my colleague, Franklin Garcia, did one with her. She is the 92-year-old co-founder of the United Farm Workers with Cesar Chavez, and she did one to reach out to the Latino community for us. So thank you to both those people for their dedication to our cause. And now, without further delay, let's bring on Doug and talk about some of the issues of the day. And let's start with California statehood. Doug, how are you?
I am doing wonderful. Quick congratulations. We love you here. And regarding my life, not bad. It's exciting times. California is going through a possible change that could be very impactful. Gotta love that.
Yeah, it's crazy. And thank you for that. Congratulations. It was a tough campaign. But it's over for now. And on to November. But, California has put in motion a thing to get on the ballot. I guess it's a referendum to get on the ballot to divide the state into three separate states. What do you think of that?
Wow. You know, in my lifetime, I haven't seen it happen. But the idea that it's possible. And in California's case, in some cases, people would argue that it's necessary, while others would say it's preposterous. You can see it along a lot of different lines. Yeah. For example, California has a huge population, and each person, you know, there might be 300,000 individuals to the representative. You know, in other states, you think in terms of half that and lower, much lower. So could that help California along some lines? Yes. You know, there's been a question as to, is it Republican or Democrat? And you can see the influence of, you know, a population in certain areas of California. And I always thought that that would stop it. You know, you wouldn't move forward on that if one party thought that would benefit only that party. So I think it would take, you know, a lot to get it to happen. But, boy, you, on the good side, I love when you have government that comes back to the people and is more accountable on some level. Just make it more accountable on some level and make it easier for us to be a part in it. And maybe at the state, maybe if we broke it up, that might be something to factor in. Plus, I believe in law. And I believe we all need a universal set of Gaia principles. But I also believe that you need different types of communities in all directions in order to stimulate the best idea. That's true even at the government level and on a local level. So without that, we can fall prey to, you know, the same understanding when it comes to building companies as monopolies.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you make a good point. There's one thing I have to correct you on, though. All representation in the House is equal because representation in the House is based right. on population. So everybody right. you would have 300,000. Right. California has more congressmen, right. but representatives. My assistant would kill me for saying congressmen. But senators, that's certainly true. And another thing that's true is where you have, like, this is off the top of my head, but you have 15 states along the East Coast. Mm-hmm. On the West Coast, you only have 3 states.
Right.
You have California, Oregon, and Washington. Right. So California takes up the space of what on the East Coast would be at least a half a dozen states. So right. in terms of population and land area and other things, they certainly qualify. And it might help us. It might be easier to bring 4 states into the union right. than it is to bring 1. But the one thing that does bother me about it is the whole idea that you would break up a state, as you've already pointed out, for representation. For example, people say to us sometimes, maybe Washington, D.C., should partner with Northern Virginia, mm-hmm. and that way you could give something to the Republicans, because Northern Virginia is solidly Democrat, and the rest of the state is Republican. So if you took it into the if you made a state out of Washington, D.C. and Northern Virginia, you'd have a Democratic state, and then the rest of Virginia would be a solid Republican state. Right. Well, I hate to start that ball, because, right? I mean, that's like gerrymandering on steroids.
Right.
They would. Who wouldn't want to cut out a little enclave in every state and solidly Republican states like sure. Texas and Utah, sure. the little Democratic enclaves would complain. And solidly Democratic states like New York and I don't know, maybe Georgia, they would complain. The Republicans would complain. So yeah. God knows we could end up with 150 states
right.
if we're not careful.
Where does it end?
Where does it end? But right. but I think it's a really intriguing proposition. And the thing that I like most about it, it's getting people to think about statehood in ways they haven't done before. And this really is not a national discussion that we've really had since the 1950s when we brought in Hawaii and Alaska. So right. I think it's good to get everybody talking about it. So we'll see what happens.
And, I agree.
Yeah.
And I think the biggest move Trump could do right now is unite all, you know, the D.C. and bring it in as part of the state, Puerto Rico. Why not? And he would be the unifier. I know this seems crazy, but you want to actually make it. What would they do then? You know what would be interesting? Throw that out there. Make it occur and see if the Democrats still attack him.
Well, you know what? I mean, it would be, you know, Puerto Rico has made a big move towards statehood in the past year, ever since the hurricane especially. Sure. So that would be an interesting thing. And there are people that say if we can get our statehood bill through the House and the Senate, you know, if things change in the upcoming elections, who knows what Trump will do?
Right.
Who knows what he'll do?
Right.
And Yeah, that certainly would be interesting to try that. I want to bring up an issue now, which is going to get me in trouble with liberals, but it really bothers me. And I got to tell you, you know that we have stood firmly behind this gay couple in Utah that wanted a baker to bake them a wedding cake, and right. the guy refused.
Right.
And we said that's wrong, and I believe it is wrong. But over the weekend, Sarah Huckabee Sanders was asked to leave mm-hmm. a restaurant called the Red Hen mm-hmm. in Virginia because the owner doesn't like the fact that she works for Trump.
Right.
And the Washington Post wrote an article about it, kind of heralding the restaurant owner for having the guts to ask her to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to tell you, it bothers me mm-hmm. that we're always using a double standard
right.
and we no longer have an idea of what is right and wrong. What's right is when you're doing what I want you to do, and what's wrong is when you're not doing what I want
right.
you to do. And I think that's horrible. If it makes sense that the baker in Utah has to bake the cake, which I believe it does, I think it makes sense that the restaurant owner has to serve Trump employees whether she likes Donald Trump or not.
Right. Well, yes. I mean, if you allow racism to occur, any sort of that, for every single vendor or every single store owner or every, you don't want to, that's not the right way to handle it. You should serve people equally, not based on
right.
anything.
Right.
And it's a problem when that doesn't occur, but you're right. The thing that's killing the Democratic Party today and for a long time now is what they're doing, these double standards. When you
yeah.
start seeing, you know, them getting up and screaming about things just for the sake of, you know, making the opposite point of view, even if it's ridiculous, like Maxine Waters standing up saying there should be revolts. Why are you inciting people just for the sake of inciting? They're inciting things based on things that aren't really real. They're kind of, you know, they're pushed out there because they present a particular image or a picture. And I'm not saying, you know, Trump's a good guy. I'm not. I mean, you get to a billionaire status, you have to hurt people.
Me either. And you know what? If I'm in that restaurant and Sarah Huckabee Sanders sits down next to me, I actually know her father and like him very much. But if she sits down next to me and I decide that I don't want to eat next to her, I can stand up and leave.
Right.
That's my right. That's my prerogative.
Right.
But I don't think the restaurant owner has the right. If you're out there and you're listening and you have an opinion, I'd love for you to call in and talk to us about this, because I think this is an important issue. We need a set of standards that everybody goes by.
I think it should be put into law, codified in some way, because it is that important to make sure that we don't do that.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. I mean, what if it were 1965 and Martin Luther King came in
right.
and you thought he was a rabble rouser and you didn't want to serve
right.
him? Well, certainly there were people that didn't want to serve him.
Right.
And we went to the mat, right? There's a great movie that was done several years ago on Hallmark Hall of Fame called Skokie, about Skokie, Illinois is a suburb outside of Chicago where a lot of Holocaust survivors ended up settling.
Mm-hmm.
And in the early 1960s, the American Nazi Party decided to have a demonstration there specifically because there were so many Holocaust survivors. And of course, many of the Holocaust survivors stood up against them having a protest. And the ACLU got involved, mm-hmm. but the ACLU got involved on the side of the Nazis
mm-hmm.
because they said, if you say the Nazis mm-hmm. can't speak, then
right.
you also got to say that you know,
right.
Liberal groups can't
right.
speak. And it's a very interesting, it's a tough question. It's a tough issue because the Holocaust
right.
survivors were in so much pain and you sided with them, you know.
Right.
But then you could see the point that the ACLU made. And you know, we're about to face this in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
These horrible, horrible people that did that march in Charlottesville where that young girl was killed. They've applied for a permit to come to Washington, D.C. and protest on the mall next month in July. And Park Service is considering that right now. So this is an issue we're going to have to face again. But I think that we need to have a standard, and both sides have to live up to that standard, whatever the standard is. Yeah, so
I agree.
Well, while we're talking,
at least we're on the same page.
Yeah, well, you and I are always on the same page. You know, and America, if you're out there listening, if you would just let me and Doug run everything, there would be no problems, okay? Just next time you go to the ballot box, just write in Mike and Doug. They'll know who you're talking about. And that's if right. we get in control of everything, we'll solve all the problems of the world. I don't know. It might take
us a week.
Turkey
in every pot.
But yeah, turkey in every pot. Exactly. Except for you vegetarians. We want to be politically correct. A tofurkey for you.
Right.
So, seriously, yeah, I think both sides need to see more clearly what the standards are. And now.
Well, do you think we're getting lost in the what's the Democratic message now? Does anybody really know?
Right now, we don't like Donald Trump. That's
right,
our message.
Right.
What kind of message is
that? I'm still confused by that. I can't see. I can see that as a theme, but I see no other theme moving anybody in any direction. And that's almost like I'm giving money to a person who wants to watch TV all day.
Well, you know, we do have a bunch of issues. We certainly have those, but we haven't coalesced around a platform of
right.
any kind of issues
well,
at
your
all
work,
at this
that's
point.
True.
And we need to do that.
Right.
We need to do that. We need to spell it out right. for the American people what we stand mm-hmm. for, and we need to make sure that's consistent. And you know what? One thing we should have learned from the last election is that we've lost touch with the American people. The people that are the backbone of the Democratic Party, that have been members of our party forever, working class people, they voted against us. And it's because we lost touch with them. You know, I saw a report today that said that tariffs that have now been put on soybeans by the Chinese. The Chinese are the number one consumers of American soybeans. They consume like 60% of all of our soybeans.
Wow.
That they've already affected prices by 15%. There's been a 15% drop in soybean prices. And all the five biggest soybean producing states went for Trump. There's seven of them that are major soybean producers. The five biggest went for Trump. One that didn't go for Trump almost went for Trump. That's Minnesota. So the people that elected Donald Trump and put him in office are now being hurt by his tariffs.
Sure.
And his international trade program.
There's some justice.
Yeah, well, and you know, it's that you have to think, but who do we blame for that? Do we blame Trump completely, or do we blame Democrats too for not outlining what our agenda is to these people so they understand that we still stand
well,
for working people?
I got a question. Let's say you have two pieces of property, and both pieces of property have a unique thing. And the other property needs it. Well, what if you need the thing you're giving away more internally than you can by giving it away, and your property is the only one that holds it? How do you really value that trade and make an understanding where you have a diminishing set of resources? How do you say, okay, we're going to give it to you at our price, and you know, you've got more of this, but it doesn't matter. You know, in some way, that resource, it's hard to give it a value like that, and I see that this might be a way to, you know, stop a lot of these companies from losing money at the same time they probably will by doing this in the long run. But ultimately, what if you've got 90% or 99% of the precious metals like China does, and we need them.
Well, that's right. And that's why open trade is so important, right? Because when you start putting these, when you start putting these barriers up, then you know what? I'm going to protect my precious resource, just like you're going to protect your precious resource.
Sure. It's tough not to get into that sort of a battle. I don't know what the answers are. I don't.
Well, I think the answer is free, you know, one of the answers is free trade. And you know, I got to tell you, my experience, my limited experience in the world teaches me that rich people never suffer. No matter what, if you're rich, you don't suffer. So when you talk about the kind of scenario that you're talking about and barriers going up and people being protectionist and things like tariffs, it's the regular consumer that suffers in this. You know, the rich guys always figure out a way to stay rich.
Sure, sure. But what if the free trade, you know, affects rice and I have a lot of rice to give you and I need 90% of it for my own people and you've historically taken 20%. And then I cut you back and I say, well, you know, is free trade like here's this much I can sell you this year and you'll have it the price of the world? Or is free trade saying, you know, this is a problem. I now need to raise the price on other countries so it doesn't come in and affect me. Do you see what I mean? I don't know what the answer would that on limited resources when there's a disproportionate amount on two different locations controlled by the other. How do you make up for that disparity and yet still think, oh, well, if everything was like that, everything's free trade. It's like saying maybe, you know, everything has the same value to you and me. Well, no, rice has more value to me right now than it might to you than it wants that 20%. How can you do that without some sort of mechanism to make up for those, you know, situations? What do you do?
Well, it is a problem, you know, that, and we certainly see it in the oil business, for example. The spot market price of oil makes oil prices go up, right? Because in certain parts of the world, oil's worth more. And you know, they talked about this pipeline. They were going to build the pipeline across the United States and the XL pipeline. And part of the problem that people had with it is that a lot of oil that was going to come out at the end of the pipeline was going to be shipped to other countries. It wasn't actually going to be used to make the United States energy self-sufficient because they can get more money for it in other places than they can get for it in the United States. So that is a problem. And, you know, government policy can help with that, but it certainly can't totally resolve it. We see that in the example that you're using with rice. We see that with price supports in PL 480, which is the farm bill. You know, there's all sorts of price supports that farmers get based on spot market world prices, and the government makes up the difference so that we can have critical farm, you know, if it doesn't make sense for you to grow grain because you can't make as much money at it, the government will support that, give you a price support so that it makes it profitable for you to go out and do that. And that certainly is a help. But, you know, as you well know, those things can be manipulated.
And not when every country could employ that.
Right. Not every country can employ it. And, you know, when I covered the farm bill, you know, they're very clever. The big grain companies, there's grain companies like Cargill Grain that has hundreds of millions, literally hundreds of millions of acres. When I covered the farm bill, they said that one out of every three loaves of bread in America was baked with Cargill grain. Well, they come in and they bring a little farmer from Tennessee who has 1,000 acres that's been in his family for 200 years. And he talks about how important price supports are to keeping his family farm alive. And that's true. But while this guy's keeping his family farm alive, the corporate farmers that own hundreds of millions of acres are making millions and millions and tens of millions of dollars for not doing anything.
Sure.
You know, those programs are very often abused as well.
I believe it's
a tough balance.
I'm sorry. People don't follow, let's say, they might follow the law, but if without right intention, you know, I think a lot of us, if we can make a dollar and it's not illegal, we just do it. Oh, so it hurts other people. Well, it's, you know, the capitalistic way, isn't it?
Yeah.
And there's a lot of moral problems with the way we operate. We don't look at it along that sort of a principled line, you know, where the intention to do no harm is really evident in what you're doing.
Well, and that's why you need government. And you know what? This is what bothers me when people say, and Trump got elected in a large part by saying this, that government needs to run like business. And when people say government needs to run by like business, they mean it needs to be efficient like business. But it can't be run like business. That's why, for example, you have government. If business could run everything, you wouldn't need government. But there's one thing that always comes up is a balanced budget. People say, well, we need to have a balanced budget. You know, I have a balanced budget. I don't go out and spend money that I don't have, which isn't true. We all buy on credit. But for the most part, you know, I don't go out and spend money that I don't have. But, you know, here's the dilemma. What if you sit, what if a hospital says they've got $1 million and they've used the money up, and then five people come into the emergency room? What do you do? Do you let those people die because you don't have the money to take care of them? You have to deficit spend if you're a government. And that's one thing people don't understand. You can try to be more efficient, but business doesn't have your best interest at heart. Business has its own best interest at heart. So you can't make everything a business. You need government to intervene and provide all the social services to provide for our protection. I mean, you know, how would you like an army that was a privatized army? It would only work for the people that could afford to pay it, and it would probably very often be under-equipped and undermanned. And, you know, there are certain things that government has to do. And so when people say, yeah, well, he's a businessman. He wasn't a very good businessman either, but he's a businessman, so he can run the government better. I don't believe in that. I believe that government has a heart and business really doesn't.
Well, but here's where government could help. Like, let's say, I mean, the idea, the model that business is going to help. It's almost like the Democratic Party, to get back to an earlier point, needs to go back to square one like you do with a company. Well, first you'd hammer out your mission statement. Then you'd hammer out, you see my point, going back to that to define itself. It needs to do what a company normally does to figure it all out. Question to you. What do you think? Is this true? Is it nonsense? Is it, you know, if it is true, what does this really mean? It's a thing that's sat on my brain for the longest time. Actually, the day before 9/11, when Ronald Rumsfeld said, oh, we got $2.1 trillion missing in the Pentagon or the budget here. And then, you know, after that, we heard it was $6 trillion. Now we hear by some accountant that's gone in, taking a look at the military spending budget between now and, let's say, 1995, there's $21 trillion missing that's unaccounted for. That is beyond staggering. That's more than the GDP of the United States of America in a one-year term.
Well, I got to tell you, I don't know the exact figure, but it's funny that you should ask me this question, because I used to be the administrator of a thing called the Defense Budget Project. And at the Defense Budget Project, we were the guys that found out that the Air Force was paying $800 for a screw to go in a plane, or $750 for a toilet seat to go on a plane. You know, we found so much government waste. In fact, at one time, we calculated that if you took all the fraud in social programs that they had talked about since the beginning of welfare, that there had been more cost overruns and fraud on just the M1 tank than all other fraud if you took the worst figures. Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, there's just –
It's mind-boggling. It's so big that my mind has to sidestep it. I actually can't hold the government accountable almost in my brain because it's almost too astronomical a number to be true. It hasn't registered.
Well, you know, and this is something that people are always talking about when they run for office. They're always talking about, where are you going to get the money? Are you going to raise taxes? No, we're going to cut waste and fraud. We're going to cut waste and fraud. But the waste and fraud that they're going to cut is waste and fraud in programs they don't like. They're not going to cut waste and fraud where it actually exists necessarily. You know, defense is a good example.
Sure.
Defense, you know, it's something we all need. We all care about, right? We all care about having a strong defense in the world. And so it's hard to crack down on it. And we all want our military to be well-equipped. You know, we send these young men and women into harm's way to protect us, and we want to make sure we're doing the best to protect them when they do it. But so that's a very hard thing to rein in. But, man, if I had to pick one area where there's the most fraud and abuse, I would say it's probably in military spending. That's a guess on my part. But
well, what's that equate to?
What do you mean?
Per person per year, let's say.
I don't know.
But let's say it's a couple thousand bucks.
It's a lot.
Yeah. It's a lot that there's no accountability. It's almost more than I pay in taxes, per se. It's just a lot of money, and there's no account. That worries me because I believe the government is getting to a point where it doesn't think those sorts of things are important. And they really are. They really are. Because if you don't know what you're doing on a number, maybe they're trying to hide it. And if that's true, just tell us. You know, we hide this amount. This is great. Let me live with that. But if I distrust you, there's something worse. I'd rather
you say there's
a reason why we won't give, rather than speculating and having a distrust. And there's no clear answer. Nobody's given any clear answers to this so far. Right? It's just like a big black hole, and now we're supposed to live with it. Well, from that can, you know, a lot of things result. People get despondent, they get apathetic, they believe that issue is so big, why worry about all the little issues? I mean, gosh, because that really is a big issue, you know. So it can be a little overwhelming to somebody who believes that, you know, you have at least some accountability. When we're talking $1 trillion a year, we're not talking peanuts here.
No, and you know what? That, you know, when you look historically at politics, that was, for example, the problem with Richard Nixon, the whole Watergate thing, was not that finding out the secrets of the Democratic Party was that big a deal. You know, I used to say, I worked at the Democratic National Committee, and I used to say, if you wanted to know our deepest, darkest secrets, all you had to do was go unjam the Xerox machine, you know, because they always left, right? I can't tell you. I was one of the guys that had a key. We had a big, gigantic Xerox machine, and I was one of the guys that had a key to it. And I can't tell you how many top secret memos I pulled out of the jam Xerox machine. But the thing was that it eroded trust in our government. You know, that our government would do that. That at the highest levels, that they would sneak around, and that they would then try to cover it up. And that was really, and that's a much bigger problem you know, what absolutely the fraud itself. And, you know, I could just tell you on a local level, this is my favorite. I call this the folly trolley in D.C. We built a streetcar line that's a little over 2 miles long. It cost us $200 million to build, and it cost us $50 million to maintain so far. It's been open for a couple of years. We can't even charge people to ride on it.
Really?
Because nobody wants to ride on it.
Oh, wow.
And when you go by it, nobody's on it.
Oh,
it's got
wow.
like 10 people on it. I have affectionately named it the Folly Trolley
Museum.
People hate people in government hate that I call it the folly trolley. But that's $360 for each man, woman, and child that lives in the District of Columbia.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, I mean, things like there's tremendous, you know, and they'll say somebody will stand up and say, well, a million people rode on the H Street streetcar line. We just passed 1 million people after 2.5 years. That's what Metro carries in a day and a half. and it took them 2.5 years, you know, but everybody wanted it. You know, all the politicians wanted it. They did it. They even destroyed a bunch of little businesses who went out of business because it took years of digging up the streets in front of their establishments, you know.
Oh, boy.
But nobody wants to take responsibility for it. But, you know, it's funny that we all know some of these very basic things about politics, right? And it's the emperor's new clothes, you know? The emperor comes out naked, but everybody sees him, right? Right? Because they don't want to offend him. That's how the streetcar line is, for example. Now, everybody's like, oh, well, it's great. Oh, I wrote on it, and it's just wonderful, you know? Yeah, and the Washington Post sent a reporter out there, and he walked the 2 miles faster than the streetcar line, than the streetcar went. So, yeah, and meanwhile, we have kids that are suffering in Anacostia. My house, my wife and I had to refinance our house because – We were having a few things that it needed to be painted, and we needed to do some remodeling. So we took some of the equity out of it. It was appraised at 3.5 times what we bought it for 25 years ago. So, you know, you can't afford to live. We couldn't afford to buy it today if we had to buy it.
Yeah.
So these are real problems. And you know what? In the midst of all this, I got to tell you, people, I just ran in the Democratic primary in District of Columbia. The Democratic primary is the only election that really counts in the district because most of us are Democrats. 17% of the registered voters voted. 17% in the nation's capital.
Crazy.
Crazy.
Yeah.
It should be 95%. In Australia, 95% of the people vote. And the other 5% are probably sick or you know, disabled or, you know, have some legitimate excuse for not showing up. We don't show up because we don't think it matters. Mm. It matters. Mm. Vote, people. No matter who you vote for, get out there and vote because it makes a difference. So let's move on to the 800-pound gorilla in the middle of the room, Doug. They're arresting kids and separating them from their parents at the borders. One day, President Trump says he's not doing it. The next day, he says he is doing it, but it's Congress's fault. The next day, he says it can't be resolved by an executive order. The next day, he signs an executive order that resolves it. What do we do about this? Look, I have friends, the former host of this show, Kathleen Gomez, grew up in a border town, and her people write me regularly on Facebook and tell me how horrible conditions are in their little town of Douglas, Arizona. So I absolutely believe that there are horrible things going on the border and that we need to address this problem. There needs to be tight border security. So I do not take this lightly. But on the other hand, as a father of 3 children, I can't imagine separating my wife from one of her 8-year-old children or separating me from my children. I just think it's barbaric. I've seen these camps that they put on the border, these tent camps. We've now heard stories of children who have been separated from their parents for you know, 10 days a week, and nobody knows where they are, and they don't know where their parents are. So what do we do about this? Do you have any insights, as brilliant as you are?
I actually, on some, they want to leave because the place they're from is in terrible state.
Right.
I mean, there's more murders happening in Mexico than,
right.
And so we have to have compassion for that. But yeah. I also think on some level that you need the participation of the country that's allowing for that to occur. You know, maybe if you really wanted to, you'd work together to maybe you have, you know, border towns that are made up of, you know, maybe military units or government agencies, but kind of border towns where you have that support coming from one end through to the other. So both sides are participating in this. You don't have just one side. And you have a few of those centers, a lot of them, in fact, because we need to, you know, be there for the people. You can't just have, you know, all no doors. So there's not enough of that, I think.
Well, I agree with that. I think, right? And I don't know if it even takes sending, if it's gotten to the level where we need to send troops into Nicaragua and Guatemala and Honduras and some of these other countries where now they have the highest murder rates in the world.
True.
You know, maybe we do. Maybe we have to intervene militarily, because I agree with that. I think that we can't just take in these people without. I think we need to be compassionate, but I think that there really are serious problems along the border, and that we need to address that. And I think that as long as governments will stand out of the way and let us do it, they will let us do it. I think we need to hold the feet of governments rather than the feet of these poor people that are trying to escape. I think you're right. I think we need to hold the feet of the governments that they're trying to escape from. I think we need to hold them to the fire. That's a great point.
And we're also, you know, it's one thing that there's a vast amount of power now by great works of machinery that can spin a tail instantly and affect you on an emotional level and know you, kind of. So they keep on giving you ads, even despite the fact that that ad might be contrary to what they believe. They know it'll make you emotionally this. So,
that's another really great point. I mean, you have a press conference. You have a press conference that they held, that the president held a few days ago, with all these people coming up talking about how their family members have been victims of crimes from illegal, undocumented aliens and illegals, which may in fact be true. But, you know, the actual fact is that immigrants have lower crime rates than the indigenous population. We create more crimes than immigrants do, which makes sense because you snuck into the country. The thing you want to do is keep it on the down low, right? You don't want to draw attention to yourself.
Right.
So the truth of the matter is that those rates are lower, and that border crossings are at a 40 year low right now. But it's also true that, you know, I can tell you from the emails I get from people that they're really distressed in towns like Douglas. They've seen they've seen their cities just their towns just dilapidate and all sorts of crime and other problems. So it's a real problem. These people aren't just saying this; it's really going on. So we really
Well, it's hard to have. You know, on a spiritual level, one would argue that you have to take emotion out of dealing with a situation, you know, on some level. But it's really hard not to be emotional towards what's occurring because everybody has a story and they don't want to suffer. But you, how do you
do
make
it? Do we have a caller?
Yes, one moment, please.
All right.
Whoops. My caller's gone. We missed him. We missed him. But I tend to believe there's got to be some sort of vetting process. You can't let, like, you can't let your public, your school system, let's say, okay, everybody come in who wants to be, I'd love that, you know, but in many cases it might be very disruptive. So you have disruption occurring and people aren't used to that disruption and they're not being compensated really for that disruption. So there's anger. So there's anger.
I get it. And I get the anger, and sometimes I think we don't get the anger, you know, and that's one of the reasons that we had to show. Oh, there they are again. Get them, Doug. Don't let them leave. Hello?
All right. We have Lynn with us. Lynn,
what do you want to say?
Hello. This is concerning the Democratic platform. And sort of a concept, a new age, sort of WPA, instead of a CCC, developing actual heart and soul-based community services for nurturing, caring community services with a good basic guaranteed income with single payer. so we can pull people back into communities. And at the soul level, it's healing people of their emotional problems. It realigns people to go beyond race, religion, and genders, too, in every community, to work together at a new, you might want to call it new age, I don't know, level of cooperation and cohesion, so that we can help stop the violence from inside out, even the warring paradigm, too.
Well, you know, I understand that, Lynn, and I know that people talk about that, but, you know, the other side would tell you, how do we pay for this? How do we pay for a WPA-type program? And those of you that might not remember what that is during the Second World War, the government put people to work, particularly artists and other people, rebuilding the infrastructure of America. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about, rebuilding our infrastructure?
Yes, and as far as the funding goes, it needs to counter. We already have 1,000 military bases in 156 countries, and we really need to counter that and bring in our children. And it also, all drug highs are free at the soul level when you're teaching heart and soul programming, so that it really can get beyond the drug wars and the violence and the military insanity that we keep building. So the job, the money's there. We just need to see the benefits to the communities and how important and healthy and for the conscious evolution of our species and the new, you know, communities that will come together beyond these old issues of race, religion, and gender.
Yeah, it's, you know, I really feel what you're saying, Lynn, and I think that's an important point, and we thank you for your comment. You know, those things, unfortunately, some of those things like race and gender bias and things like that, they change very, very slowly, and it's a shame. You know, we like to say that we're not as racist as we used to be, and that's probably true, but there still is plenty of it out there. There's plenty of racism, there's plenty of sexism, and every once in a while we see it raise its ugly head, you know, and maybe things like the Me Too movement that we see now and other things that are coming to the forefront, Black Lives Matter and other groups that are standing up and addressing this head on. Maybe that's the legacy of what's going on now, is that we are reaching a new awareness. Let's hope that's the case.
Good
Thank
point.
Thank you for calling in.
Good point.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, what do we do about that? It evolves very, very slowly. And, you know, we've pushed it. I think we've pushed some of these things under the surface, right? Because mm-hmm. it's no longer politically correct to talk about them. Right. But obviously they're still there. They're still there because of what you just said, Doug, a few minutes ago, that you can spin something and immediately there's all these people willing to take it up, right? They're like, aha, you know? What I used to say, I was blessed that I had a father that didn't have a prejudice bone in his entire body, but I had people on my mother's side of the family who were prejudiced, and I used to say, you know, they wouldn't remember if an African American gave them a kidney, but they would remember every black person they ever saw cash a welfare check in a liquor store. You know what I mean? They look for things that support their belief, and they go, aha!
Right.
You know, and you hear it all the time. People give you an anecdote. Rather than look at the statistics, they go, oh, yeah, well, I know this guy down the street, and he's just a horrible person, and he's, you know, this ethnic group or that ethnic group. Okay, well, that's one person out of 4 billion people, you know, even if it's true.
You know, you got to wake up. I wake up, I promise you. Internally, I wake up happy and optimistic. It affects my day. Then there are people that wake up have a problem. They're festering on it, on their brain, and usually the rest of the world is going to be a part of that process because it's very... So I start your day, I'd say the first thing we all should do as politicians is just let's have a, you know, maybe all politicians should have this as their... you know, thing that they do. Just wake up and think to yourself, I'm, you know, it's a good day and I'm optimistic. rather than
right, and you're alive, and the world is a great place. And,
right,
you know that should be. Look, right. I'm out campaigning, and there's these people that have these big signs up that say "Dump Trump," and some guy comes by and he starts screaming at me. And I'm saying to him, sir, that's not my sign. And he goes, oh, this is horrible. And I said, I know how you feel, sir, but that's not my sign. See, this is my sign. It says vote for Michael Brown. It doesn't say anything about the president. That's not my sign. And he's just screaming at me. And finally goes, well, you're a Democrat, aren't you? And I go, well, yeah, I'm a Democrat. And he goes, well, they're Democrats, aren't they? And I said, well, I guess they are. Yeah, but it's not my sign.
That's hilarious. You
know, it didn't matter. You know, he was just needed somebody. And, you know, when you're an elected, one of the things that it's actually it honors me, to be honest with you. But when people find out, when they come, especially at a polling place where I'm standing out, handing out literature, trying to get people to vote for me. Now we had 80 people out on the street on election day, but I go to a place or I go to several places and they want to tell you what their problems are when they find out you're elected. And I feel good about that. I feel like, well, you know, that's my responsibility, right? I've taken on this responsibility of public office. And even if somebody wants to tell me about potholes, which I can't do anything about because I'm the senator. But when they want to tell me, I listen, right? Sure. And I try to be at least sympathetic about it. Sure. And if I know somebody in the Department of Transportation or where to send their grievance, I tell them. I try to be as helpful as I can. But yes, yeah, some people just, you know, they want you as a point of contact, mm-hmm. and they want to unload on you. Mm-hmm. And we see it all the time. We see people that you might meet in a social situation that is, they're just the nicest people, and then they get behind the wheel of their car, they get stuck in traffic, they're screaming out all sorts of obscenities right. at you, cutting you off and slamming on the brake. Right. You know, they turn from a nice person into Attila the Hun.
And they do.
They do.
They do it. That I've seen it happen so many times. It's unbelievable.
Oh my God, we have it. And here in Washington, which is a city that was a beautiful city, never really meant to have cars in it. You know, it's got big traffic circles and wide boulevards and narrow streets and alleys. You know, it was designed to be beautiful more than it was to be practical, designed long before the automobile was really invented. We have a lot of that. We have a lot of that. And we have strange things in Washington, like in rush hour, traffic that's four lanes one way switches to five lanes. And two lanes the other way. Well, how we don't get more people killed doing that, I don't know. But one, you know, at 10 o'clock in the morning, you're driving down Connecticut Avenue and it's four lanes, and then at 5 o'clock at night, you're driving the same direction and it's two lanes. So, you know, and nothing's changed except a sign that says now instead of four lanes, it's two lanes. And if you're not paying attention,
You know what we got to do, Mary, to something famous like Burning Man with a political theme, or do something where each community has a celebration or, you know, maybe something that revolves around politics and learning it, but big, fun, you know, and enjoy. It's like a community event, and maybe every community puts on this event to integrate the people with their local council, but it's fun. It's not, it wouldn't be boring and dry, because if you had boring and dry, you're done, right?
Well, here you go. This is my idea generated from Doug the Genius. We're going to have July the 4th celebrations all across America.
I love it.
2 weeks.
Such a good idea.
If you're a Democrat, go find a Republican on the 4th of July and hug them. And if you're a Republican, go find a Democrat on the 4th of July and hug them and say, God bless that we're all live in a country where we can be free and where we can, you know, be what we want to be in life. And God bless America and God bless each other. And that's what I'm going to leave this show tonight on, because that note, because
brilliant,
we're out of time.
Words.
and I'm going to ask Doug to play my single favorite campaign song of all time. It was written by one of the worst politicians in the history of the United States, a guy named Huey Long, who was terribly corrupt. He was a senator from Louisiana who was assassinated on the floor of the Senate, but he wrote one hell of a campaign song. So we're going to leave you with Every Man a King, done by Randy Newman. This was his campaign song, and we'll see you next week. Marie and I will be back, and thank you, Doug, for making the show so interesting tonight. I really appreciate it.
I'm so grateful. I really am. And my top hat to you, Senator Michael Brown.
Thanks. See you next week, folks.
Why weep or slumber, America, land of brave and true? There's castles and clothing and food for all. All belongs to you. Every man a king, every man a king, for you can be a millionaire. If there's something Give the people their right to vote.